welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Tape Show. Yeah, Steve Barish was hot last night. I got home and was ready to join him, but I heard he was doing so well that I just decided to let him carry on. So anyhow, tonight we've got another little thing here to play, and I think you'll enjoy it.
This verse from the Bible, which is the primary scripture of the ancient Vedas, translating in English means this. It's being spoken directly by the Supreme Personality of God. And he said,
this is Scott, who wrote with me on my book, Rays of Truth, and he's talking about the Vedas, which is very good, with music in the background.
The 50s, in the 50s, the 30s, in the 40s, 30s in the 50s and the 60s. Translating in English means this. It's being spoken directly by the Supreme Personality of God. And he says, in order to enter into the mysteries of yoga and the universe, you must become my friend as well as my devotee. So God here is speaking and he says, become my friend, become devoted to me, and I will allow you to enter into the mysteries of the universe. Now, the astounding thing about this verse is that we often think of the environment as perhaps a cold, mysterious, large, black, infinite universe with billions of stars and galaxies and possibly, for those of you who are just beginning this study, extraterrestrial cultures that may or may not be out there. But in the ancient times, many of these extraterrestrial beings were known to come to Earth and participate in earthly activities, and they are described elaborately in the Vedas. The ancient Vimanas, or flying machines that are described in the Vedas, go back 10,000 years ago when they were first recorded in the Vimanika Sastra as being shown part of the Ramayana and some of the other ancient scriptures. I'll be describing some of these later, and it'll be more of the scholarly part of this section. I don't want this to become too much of a scholarly expose or anything too official or too in any way foreign-seeming or intimidating. Why? Because this is your tape series. This tape series is not only designed by Dr. Bell and myself to give you a clear understanding of the UFO phenomena, what has gone on with the UFO phenomena, and a lot of the esoteric teachings behind the extraterrestrials, but it is also something that, this is why I'm describing the teachings of the neural life illumination from the Vedas, because this is a very ancient Earth science that has been on this planet for a long, long time. So we don't want to have you feel like you're being brought too much information that is so intergalactic that it doesn't ring home for you. It must be something that you can apply in your life and find it to be useful in helping you become more connected with your own inner ecstasy. Now, the process of life illumination is so beautiful because it takes who and what you are sitting right now listening to this tape and helps you to understand of your existence as an individual spirit soul made up what is described in the Vedas as Sat Chit Ananda, which is knowledge, eternity, and ecstasy, or blissfulness. Now, in those Vedas too, ecstasy, or bliss, is described as the food for sat and chit, which is knowledge and feelings of eternity, which are usually brought up during periods of meditation or periods where there's a lot of elation in your life. But anandam is the living condition, and it is experienced neurologically through the nervous system of the experience of this phenomenon. You see, we are so conditioned to experience ourselves in a limited way, or a way that is possibly full of pain or problems or dilemmas, that we never get a glimpse beyond the state where dilemmas don't exist, but we see ourselves as the primal energy force of ecstasy living behind the dilemmas, behind the dramas that keep us back from feeling our total unity and our real self in connection with the universe. Now, if you take a drop of water, for example, out of the ocean, you use a little eyedropper and you pull a drop of water out of the ocean and you put it under a microscope, you will find that that drop has all the same chemical constituents as the entire ocean. The presence of H2O, hydrogen, two parts oxygen, you know, the chemical constituents of water are there, and the salt, and all these other trace elements will be found in the drop as the entire ocean. So similarly, the individual soul, the jiva spirit particle, which is Satchit Ananda Jiva, as described in the ancient Sanskrit, is a drop of the infinite ocean of Godhead, or the supreme being, the supreme universal form of God. And this individual drop, by examining themselves, can find out not only this thing that I've just spoken to you to be completely true, that we are indeed ecstasy in our original condition, and we always were ecstasy, and we always are ecstasy, but that by connecting with this, we will be able to outshine all the lower dramas, the lower dilemmas that plague the psychophysical form or the body-mind. I would like to give you some information from Sanskrit that is very exciting. And listen carefully to the sound vibration of this verse. Yam Brahma Varunendraha Rudram Marut Sanvinti Divyasavir Vede Sangha Parakra Mopanusadaya Gayantiyam Shamukha Vijyanavashtita Tadgatena Monisya Pasantiyam Yogino Jashantanahu Viduhu Surasur Ganaha Devayatasmai Namaha. This verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam is spoken by the sage Vedavyasa, and he's describing at the conclusion of this great scripture the message to humanity, which is, the Bhagavatam is considered by all great saints, yogis, and spiritual masters of the Vedic disciplic successions, the Sampradayas, to be the essential conclusive wisdom of Vedic thought and aspiration. In this verse, which is indeed the concluding revelation, it is indicated that to enter the highest plane of reality, we must become submissive to God as the highest being whose spiritual form and abode transcends all of our limited conceptions and powers of knowledge. Often we give credit to our own mind as being, you know, capable of perceiving the highest limits of thought and wisdom, assuming that somehow, by our own limited experience, we can analyze all of the things that are presented before us in their entirety. Of course, the foolishness of this idea becomes obvious when we consider how, even though we put so much emphasis on our own limited sense perception, we are constantly experiencing the futility and limits of those senses. For example, right now, if the sun and the moon weren't present, the public electrical source failed, and there were no candles or flashlights, you wouldn't even be able to read or listen to this report. So you would see that the limits of your auditory, your visual, and other sensory experience would be something that would limit you automatically, just being in the psychophysical form of the body. So although we stress seeing something as proof of its existence, we are constantly reminded of the extreme limits of both our sensual, visual, and auditory capacity. The mind, according to the Vedas, is considered to be the sixth sense, and it also has similar limiting facilities. And so to prepare ourselves for the path of the neural life illumination yoga, we must first learn that to understand our limits of perception is the beginning of transcending our limits of perception. Believe it or not, this understanding will actually lead us to a higher awareness in the future. To simply sit down and face, yes, I, as an unlimited spirit soul, as a jivatma, have unlimited capacity, but I am sitting in a body and a mind. I am sitting in this body and mind, which has limited sensory capacity, limited auditory capacity, and limited visual capacity. Often when I'm lecturing around the world on the UFO phenomena, people always say, "Have you seen a UFO before?" And it's easy for me to say yes because I indeed have. I've seen physical UFOs that, on one case, one of them followed me out to the forest up in the sequoias in Northern California. It was quite an amazing experience. But often they say, well, I like your lecture, I see the documents you're presenting, it all looks pretty good, but unless I see one, I won't believe it. Well, of course, it's only natural that they say seeing is believing, but you know, in the higher wisdom, believing is also seeing. We have to understand that the ocean of faith, the ocean of faith is crossed with the boat of knowledge, but we are always on the ocean of faith. We have faith that when we come to a red light and it turns green, we have faith that the green light will be a signal to the people coming in the opposing traffic that they have to stop for us. We put our faith in that. We put our faith in the government. And ultimately, we put our faith constantly in our own sensory experience, which I've already demonstrated to you is very limited. So if we actually have ride on the boat of faith, of the higher intuition, by first of all understanding that we are in a body that is limited by the senses, including the mind, and limited by the form itself, we'll be able to get a clear understanding of who we are as our unlimited self, or the jivatma, the soul within the body that permeates the whole body. So this is a proper understanding and preparation to bring us to the path of what I call Narasingha Yoga, or Neuro-Life Illumination. Now, Narasingha Yoga, Narasingha refers to, in ancient India, the lion god. There is a deity of God in India known as Narasingha, who is a form of a lion. So in this path of Narasingha Yoga, we want to bring the lion god, or the form of the lion power, down into us. The lion god is all we have right now that can protect us, this lion power, because in the ancient times, the Narasingha appeared out of a pillar to challenge Hiranyakashipu, who at the great time was a very powerful yogi who was ruling the universe in a corrupt way for his own personal gratification. And he had become so powerful that all the gods from throughout the universe had given him the boon that he had requested, may I never die on the land, the air, or the sea. So what happened is the great god Narasingha, at one point when he became completely corrupt, burst out of a pillar, laid him on his lap with his claws, he tore open his chest and destroyed the demon, Hiranyakashipu. So this story is symbolic of how the actual power of Narasingha, or the power of God in the form of a lion consciousness, can come down into us and destroy all obstacles, including those which we often find that we present to our own selves by our own actions. We present our own problems. So this Narasingha Yoga or Neuro-Life Illumination can really help us in this. Next, within the limited jurisdiction of our sense perception, we come to primal forces that are working on our sense perception to influence us through the senses. And they're known as the modes of nature, or in Sanskrit, the gunas. Now, the gunas function in three different ways. They function known as sattva-guna, which is the positive mode of goodness, the raja-guna, which is the passion or inertia of maintenance, or controlling maintenance inertia force, the passion force, and the tamaguna, which is the force of density and ignorance. Often, whenever we do various things, we see how these modes are mixed and influencing us. That's why some days we get up and everything is just fabulous and we feel like $1 million, and some days we wake up and we feel like $1 million, only we feel like $1 million all green and wrinkly, as a joke, if you understand what I mean. In other words, we wake up and we can't get anything accomplished. So these are the forces of the modes of nature influencing us. And it's very simple and honest to simply recognize that these modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance are constantly influencing our body, our mind, and our ego. So when we understand that we are under the forces of the senses, and that those senses are under different forces of the modes of nature, it'll not only help us understand the limits of our sensory and mental perception, but it'll help us to come to understand how we can become unlimited by entering into our nature as ecstasy, as the Jiva-Atma. So, according to our understanding in personal life energy, we find that different reactions are created within our mental system according to the activities within these modes of nature. For example, the Sattva-Guna mode produces charitable activities, kindness, happiness, a caring attitude, religious tendencies, altruistic, philanthropic type endeavors, health, cleanliness, calmness, chivalry. These are examples of the modes of nature functioning in the force of goodness, or the Sattva Guna. The Raja Guna is more of a mode of passion, where you driven personality, sexual energy, physically active, desire for action, courageous, perhaps less caring about total health and cleanliness and consciousness. And of course, that's the Raja Guna. And the lower nature, the Tamaguna, is when we become influenced by low health, cleanliness, attitude. We're kind of lazy, the tendency for intoxication is there, we have a casualness of attitude towards our career and our goals and winning in life. We have a non-desire for achievement generally in the Tamaguna. You see a lot of bums who are completely under the influence of this mode, laying on a park bench with a newspaper over them. They've just given up. They're completely become intoxicated by laziness, and all they care about is their next drink. Cruelty, dark mind thoughts, fear, anxiety. These things plague all of us when we get influenced by the mode of Tamaguna, or the mode of darkness. So these different modes and their effects in the person these are not complete descriptions of each mode, but they give you a general idea of how these come and influence us. Now, the Nirguna Bhakti, or the Nadasingha Bhakti, the yoga I'm referring to, refers to Nirguna, means beyond the forces of these gunas. And the way we enter into a spiritual consciousness beyond the force of these gunas, it is performed by a person according to their particular absorption in this science of neural life illumination. So all of you, you know, without getting too complicated and too philosophical here, those of you who've read the description of the meditation in the book about visualizing an orange in your mind, seeing who is looking at the orange on the screen of the mind, this is the important thing, first of all. To see yourself as that being looking at the screen of the mind and feeling the potency of your inner self, who was there when you were in a young body in kindergarten, all through grade school, in high school. You were there watching the mind, the body, and the ego change, but you were the changeless living entity living there in the body, which is the drop of the ocean of infinity, the drop of the ocean of Godhead. So this Nadasingha Yoga, the ancient science of transcendental Nirguna Bhakti, where the aspirant transcends the modes of nature in practice and acquires this bhakti, or love, that is described in the Bhagavatam verse that we spoke at the beginning of this love for God by seeing that He is the greatest being in the world and that we are part of that universal conception, and that to realize that we have limited conception in perceiving Him because He is so great and so awesome. He created the whole universe, including all the UFO phenomena, the intergalactic beings and races, all were expansions out of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Personality of the universe. Naturally, all the tendencies of persons associated with this higher mode of Nirguna Bhakti, the lower tendencies will begin to drop off, and a person will be able to experience this ecstasy or this Nirguna Bhakti that we are describing. And we will see ourselves as a unit of consciousness described in the Srimad Bhagavatam as Satchit Ananda. And ultimately, this Satchit Ananda feeling, this description, which I hope you're getting this feeling now as you're listening to this sound vibration coming out of this tape, The food of that is the ananda, the ecstasy. We are ecstasy. We always already were ecstasy from the beginning of creation up through all our forgetfulness of that up till now, where hopefully now we are reuniting and remembering who we really are. To remember is to become, again, a member of the organization of ecstasy, the life illumination network of ecstasy, and to enter into deep, intensive practice of this, deep intensity, deep happiness of this practice. Brahmano hi pratishtatam amritas yavyayasya cha sastavasya chadarmasya sukhasya kantikasya cha. This verse, the Supreme Being is describing, the Brahman, or the light surrounding me, is coming from the aura of my body. And it is the abode of eternity, happiness, and ecstasy. So in this verse from the Gita, the Supreme Being is describing that he has a body made of spiritual or nirguna elements. Similarly, although we are wearing a material body, we also are exhibiting an aura, which is the light coming out of our soul. And the aura that people measure, a lot of times you see people take photographic pictures of the aura and things like that. All that is the light from this soul, the jivatma, seeping through the skin in the body. It's a funny way, but it's just like when you take a flashlight and you put a cloth over it, or like when we were little kids, we used to put a flashlight in our mouth. Some of you may have done that, you know, you play monster or something. But, and you see the light, the red light coming out of your mouth, that's the color it took when you put your mouth, or if you put a cloth over it, it'll shield the light. Similarly, this soul inside of our body is so bright. And of course, the more we develop it, the brighter it becomes through this understanding of neural life illumination. The light permeates out through the nervous system and then saps its way out through the skin. And that is the aura that we perceive. Often, when we see a person come up and we say, I can feel their aura. What we're feeling is the person's brightness of the soul, and we can even see with a certain kind of sixth visionary sense the light coming out, excreting out of the skin from their body. This is what the meaning of perceiving auras is and things like that. Now the soul, or the jiva atma, although transcendentally situated within the body, the soul actually, according to the Vedas, lives within the heart, is experienced through the kundalini electrical system, which was originally transplanted in the body at the time of creation, when God blew the breath of life into our nostrils, as described in the Bible. This is the description of the soul in the electrical kundalini system in the Bible. It says that God blew the breath of life into our nostrils at the time of creation. According to the Vedas, the breath of life, or the soul, the electrical system, was transplanted exactly at the moment of conception, when the sperm and the ovum connected. One of those billions of sperms connected with the ovum began to proceed. God breathed the life into the being and transplanted this subtle body, this electrical system, which later develops into a full spinal system with all kinds of fluid and everything that is running the whole body through the neurological system. The seven energy centers, or poles, that are situated are the key awareness centers of the body. They're situated rising from the lower chakra areas, or known as the chakras, in the groin area, which is represented as sexual energy, all the way up through the pineal gland, in the third eye, as it's often described, and then the top Brahmarandra chakra out the top of the head. Yogis in the past would study very strictly for literally decades and decades under the strict guidance of a guru, their teacher, and they would be able to push the soul up through these energy centers and out through the top of the head and travel to different planets and different astral type planets. Now, what's ironic is people who practice yoga on a smaller scale in America for 10 or 20 years or whatever, just a short time, have experiences of being able to astrally travel and things like that. It's quite popular in the New Age world that people are talking about these type of things. The thing that excites me about the UFO phenomenon and why I interconnected with the Vedic knowledge is that the Vedas described many of these lokas or astral planets thousands of years ago, including material planets too, that have since been measured by modern astronomy science. But they describe these different travels through these planets by the yogis. And now we have the extraterrestrial phenomenon. We're actually seeing real proof of beings coming apparently from other dimensions and other time galaxies to come and interact with our world here. So it becomes sort of a confirming factor of the reality of the Vedic knowledge. And this is what I like about it. Prior to the UFO phenomena becoming really popular and well known, a lot of people also thought that the yoga system, other than its use for health or improving your diet or your sex life or whatever, which is not the purpose of yoga, but to connect with the universe. But my point is that they thought, well, it's good on a physical level, but all this other talk about astral travel and everything is like Aesop's fable, you know, it's just imagination. But with the presence of the UFO phenomena, we can see that actually it's something that is very physically real. It's actually third dimensionally demonstrable. In other words, we can see photos of UFOs, films, things like this. So we know about the presence of these things in the third dimension, yet their manifestation coming out of a fourth dimensional realm. The original science of the Vedas was transmitted telepathically, as I mentioned to you before. Now, in this age known as Kali Yuga, where the density is more prevalent, starting about 5,000 years ago, the ancient Vedas had to be written down in Sanskrit so we could have this teaching transmitted. During my course of studies over the last 16 years, I have had personal association with my teachers in the ancient disciplic successions, the Sampradayas, who have physically transmitted this teaching to me orally, directly into my ear, specifically sitting in India along the banks of the Ganges and sitting in the jungles of Puri. I have had the electrical transmission of this ancient Vedic teaching brought to me, and I wish to share it with all of those who are interested in this. You can write to us care of the address in the book for any further classes you may want to attend or verbal teachings. Or you can write to Paradigm also, and there's more information coming out of there where you can connect with us. We'll be doing a lot of classes throughout America and in the public as we awaken people to the UFO phenomena and we introduce the science of ecstasy and the science of extraterrestrial understanding to the general public for their benefit. In 1980 to 1985, I hosted the Insights television show. And this show was very exciting. We had a large amount of viewers every week. And on the show, we described the process of transforming our lives into ecstasy through the teaching of the ancient Vedas and through understanding of the modern UFO phenomena in terms of understanding that the universe is genuinely alive and personal, and that this ancient teaching is very much real. The interesting part of the ancient Vedas is that they describe aerial devices known as Vimanas or Vimanas that were used by beings such as Lord Rama and Lord Krishna and others to fly around the different universes and galaxies. Now, a lot of people, scholars that were studying the Vedas, thought this must be some kind of fairy tale or something. But on this tape, I'm going to give you just a brief history of the Vimanas and some of the things that happened with them, so at least you have a basic education on the fact that this extraterrestrial science of physical third-dimensional flying craft goes back to very ancient times. Till now, the Vimanaka Sastra, apart from following the works and authorities, are known to have dealt with the topic of the Vimana from the Samarangana Sutta Dhara, and the Yuktikalpataru of Bhoja, which was about the 12th century AD. Also, the Maya Matam was attributed to the architect Maya, celebrated in the Mahabharata. In addition to these works, about 150 verses of the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Atharva Veda, and a lot of literary passages belonging to Ramayana and the Mahabharata, which are from the 5th and 6th century BC, as well as the Puranas, the Bhagavat, which was about the 9th century AD, the Raghuvamsam, and some references of the drama, the Abhijana Kushinkantalam of Kalidas, which was dated around the 1st century BC. Also the Abhimarak of Bharas, and the Avadhana literature of the 1st and 3rd century AD, and the Katha Saritantsagara. These and a number of literary works contain either references to graphic aerial flight or to the mechanism of the aerial vehicles used in the old ages of India. These works were researched in 68 and later published around 1973 through the International Academy of Sanskrit Research in Mysore, India. And the Vimanaka Sasa were brought to light by various people who were involved in their studies. The first reference to vehicles capable of going through the air with living beings, either mortals or gods on board, as were described in the Vedas, often the gods or the demigods were extraterrestrial beings that had come and were living on Earth. There are many references to this. It's to be found in the Rig Veda, in the hymns addressed to the twin Ashvinas, the Rubhus, and other deities. Now, these deities were the sons of the architects of the universe, and it's a whole history of stories from the Vedas that, if you read, becomes a very fascinating epic of how the creation began and how the original demigods and extraterrestrial beings were coming to this planet, and they were actually having huge, what were known as yajñas, or sacrifices for them, what we might describe as like a big party or something. And they would attract these extraterrestrial beings from the other parts of the galaxies. 2,000 years ago, when Lord Buddha came to the Earth, and he stopped all the Vedic sacrifices, and the demigods, the extraterrestrial beings of the really high nature, stopped coming here because he had gone to describe the Vedas as not important and not necessary. And the reason was, at the time, the Vedas were being used for the purpose of
time to turn it over. I love the sound of waves, though. Waves are so wavy. Yeah, wavy as it can be. And here we go again.
Of course, when these yajñas or sacrifices were stopped, the demigods, a lot of the higher beings from the universe, stopped coming to the Earth planet. The flying aerial vehicles had firstly been designated as Rath, which means vehicle or carriage, later becoming known as Vimana or Vimana. It's usually pronounced either way. I've heard it pronounced different ways too, but primarily they're either referred to as the Ratha or the Vimana. Now, when I was in India about a year ago in 1989, I went to a sacred city of Vrindavan, where Krishna actually grew up and had his pastimes on earth, and I talked to some very old holy men there, and this is a very interesting story for those of you who have followed the UFO phenomenon. You may remember the book Chariot of the Gods by von Däniken. That was one of the original books that kind of started the whole search into the UFO phenomena and its mysteries about Krishna and Rama and the Vimanas and all these things. Well, when I first approached these old sadhus, these old saintly people in Vrindavan, I showed them some pictures of UFOs, and they said, oh, and they said, Deva Ra, which means Deva means God, and Rath, as we just described, means vehicle or carriage. So they described these things, and they kind of laughed and said, oh, they come here all the time to the birthplace of Sri Krishna, to feel the energy of the birthplace of Sri Krishna. To them, it was a common thing, seeing these, what they described as Devarath. Now, Devarath, literally translated, means chariot of the gods. So a lot of this information is where the Vandanakan theories came out originally and stirred up all this interest. They were described as possessing speed faster than the mind. This aerial vehicle was triangular, large, three-tier, which means three levels, uneven, and was piloted by at least three persons. It had three wheels and were probably withdrawn during aerial flight. In one verse, the chariot is said to have had three columns, and it was generally made of any one of the three kinds of metals, gold, silver, or iron. But the metal most commonly used was gold, and the Vedic texts describe it as being for the purpose of making the craft look beautiful. Long rivets were attached to it to close off the layers of the craft, and the chariot contained honey or liquid that was served to the beings who would ride on the craft. Possessing speed faster than the mind, it moved like a bird in the sky soaring towards the sun and the moon, and used to come down to the earth with a great sound. A lot of times in the modern UFO phenomena, we hear about the great sounds that are associated with the spacecraft, and this is also described in the ancient Veda. Now, interestingly enough, for those of you who are perhaps involved in studying ancient medicine and things like these, there is a description here that the chariot had three types of food, liquid fuel, in other words, in three tanks placed above, and in a fourth vessel was filled with soma rasa. Now, soma rasa, believe it or not, is an ancient psychedelic liquid taken from this special plant that is very rare. It grows high in the Himalayas in India. It's practically impossible to find now. But there were ancient rituals with this psychedelic liquid that the yogis would take after practicing austerities for a long time, and they would travel out of their bodies taking this soma rose. Now, according to Vedas, this soma rose, this liquid beverage, was available on the Vimana, probably for the purpose of helping the people on it be prepared when the craft would pick up speed or travel through different dimensions to be able to dematerialize their body at a quicker rate. And then in describing the Vimana, we have different astounding descriptions of all the parts of them. Now, it makes you wonder if they had all these Sanskrit names for the different parts and their exact description of what they did. It really lends a lot of credibility to the fact that these objects did exist. One part, I'll just describe a few of them, there's over 50 of them. One part was known as the Vishvakriyandarpana, possibly a telescope-like instrument for viewing various actions of the world. The Shaktikarshanayantra, which was a mirror for attracting energy. In other words, it was a mirror-like device that would attract energy, possibly solar-type energy, out of the sky into the Vimana. The Puspini, or Pingala Darpana, which was an instrument for seeing lightning and controlling its effects on the Vimana. The Vijuvadashika, which was an apparatus having 12 types of electricity flowing through it. Now, this is something still unknown to modern science. Another object was described as the Patikabraka, which was a sheet of mica-like surface for use in the airplane's internal and external use for attracting solar power, solar energy. And then there was the Apashmara, which was possibly an exhaust-type device placed at the junction of the pipes where the solar energy was being attracted. And then one item is very interesting is the Stambana Yantra, which was an apparatus for arresting motion like a brake. In other words, these craft, according to Veda, would be flying at rapid speed and could apply this particular device as the Stambana Yantra and come to immediate halt in the middle of the sky. Now, those of you who've studied the UFO phenomenon at all, seen films and different things, there you can see and hear that the UFO, this is performed all the time, but they're traveling very rapidly in all kinds of different motions, and all of a sudden they'll come to an immediate stop, stand still right in the sky, hovering, and then take off again. So all I know is that these descriptions in the ancient Vedas are quite astounding, because they describe a lot of these things that were in the Vedas that are being observed now in the modern UFO phenomenon. Now consider this, if you will. Bob Day, September 21st, 1952, an article appeared in the newspaper that described that an aeroplane based on the sutras of the Vimanaka Sastra of Maharishi Bhardwaj, the manuscript of which was recently discovered by the director of the International Academy of Sanskrit Research, that there was a Vimana that was actually flown in Bombay during 1890. This information is contained in a research article in this week's issue of the Vidhata, a leading Maharashtra daily paper in Bombay. Now, the article was written under the contribution of Sri Lalubhai Kansara, who was a studying of the Vimanas for quite some time, and he discovered that in 1890, a man named Sri Talpadi first constructed a model of an aircraft in the lines laid down by the Vimanaka Sastra. The model was exhibited in an exhibition arranged by the Bombay Art Society in the 1890s. Following his success, Mr. Talpadi constructed a bigger aeroplane with the help of his wife, who was also a great Sanskrit scholar. He was also assisted by a friend and an architect from the Bombay School of Art. Now, what he had done was constructed this plane based on the descriptions of the Marutsaka and the Pushpa type of Vimanas, which were part of the Vedic knowledge. The general idea of the plane can be found in the 20th Adhyaya of the Rig Veda. That was where the general description was given. I've described to you some of those parts that were in there. Now, the plane, when it was complete, was shown to the late Justice Mahadeo Ranade, and he took him and demonstrated the actual movement of the craft to him, and he became so impressed, this Chief Justice, this judge, that he thought he should invite European experts to proceed further. But Mr. Talpadi did not agree to that because he thought it would be a sign of inferiority on their part, and that the Vedic knowledge was sufficient for them to construct it. But apparently the plane made its first and probably its last flight in 1985 in Shupati. Apparently this craft was later flown, like I said, according to this, in 1985. And the first flight was witnessed amongst a throng of persons, you know, over 100 years later. Almost 100 years later. And this is quite astounding because the plane ascended to a distance of 1,500 feet before coming down. And it says that it was equipped with automatic devices for lowering down when it reached a certain height. So, after the death of his wife in 1917, Mr. Talpadi had lost all interest. And later his relatives sold all of the different pieces and everything after this demonstration in the modern age, and it's just one of those passing events that came and went, but it was actually demonstrated, and this is documented evidence in India of the actual flying of a Vimana. So what we've done now, this will conclude our section on the ancient Vedas, the Vimana, the path of Narasimha Yoga, and the mirror of life illumination. What we've described to you on this tape, first of all, of course, and most important, is your personal entrance into this study of neural life illumination. Feeling the presence of the light, the spirit soul within your body and emanating out through the neurological system. This will be the primary importance in understanding your existence as ecstasy, and living your life in this full blissfulness in your higher awareness centers of ecstasy in your body as Satchit Ananda Jiva. We've also described some of the verses from the ancient Srimad Bhagavatam and the Vedas for the purpose of describing the ancient telepathic process and now the modern form of speaking this sound vibration to you. You know, friends, keep in mind that when you hear this tape, I want this tape to be yours. I want you to take it personally and see it as something valuable for you. When the sound of my voice goes through the microphone and reaches our ears, what happens is it goes through the canal, fluid is vibrated in the ear, and that vibration of the fluid gives a signal of a certain sound to the brain. This process is going on right now. And the ancient Veda was always based on sound vibration, and after it came from the form of telepathic communication, the first entered in the sound vibration. So this sound vibration that is coming through this tape to you, may the sound vibration purify your mind and your hearts and allow you to live in complete ecstasy. On the previous section, I've given you some ideas about our living condition as ecstasy. On this section of the tape, I want to talk to you about the environment. And I don't mean here just the environment in terms of reforestation, air pollution, and things like these, which of course are very important and urgent, but something a little different, something a little more personal that involves your day-to-day existence. The environment is the key to harmony, ecstasy, and higher consciousness. First of all, there's something that's very important for me to know that you understand clearly. I told you recently on our last session that we have limited sense perception. And the reason it's important to get this clear in ourselves is because it opens the door to unlimited thinking. Now, you may wonder how, because a lot of times we hear different tape series and positive motivation seminars about becoming unlimited and thinking unlimited and expanding your thinking, and I completely agree with that. In fact, that's what we want to promote on this series here. But by recognizing your limits, you transcend them. Remember that now. By recognizing your limits, you transcend them. Well, how is that? Because by pretending to think you're unlimited, without deep inside of yourself really clearly first understanding your natural limits, you'll only be able to go so far, because those natural limits will come back to challenge you later as you attempt to see yourself as an unlimited thinker. So first, by identifying our limits, we can develop our genuine, unlimited intergalactic consciousness. Science has proven that inside of the atom is swirling energy which ultimately forms atoms. They have not yet figured out how the energy goes from being non-physical energy to physical form, the atoms. Albert Einstein once was asked to give his definition of matter, and he said, "Matter is merely energy in a form that we can perceive by our senses." So I have a saying in regards to our living environment, and I'd like you to think about it real carefully. In fact, it has to deal with our electrical environment, the environment that is around us, in which we create our thoughts and our own reality in. Now, I have this posted on my wall because I always want to remind myself this, because it is a moment-to-moment living reality for ourselves. So I'll say it slowly. You may also want to put it on your place where you can read it on a daily basis. Here we go. What we feel, see, hear, and project through our neurological system outwards towards the present projected environment is the living condition of our reality. Now let me read that again. What we feel, see, hear, and project through our neurological system
outwards towards the present projected environment is the living condition of our reality. Our living condition is the immediate environment, and our whole existence is created by the energetic thought forms projected out each moment into it. This statement, when you read it, you get this feeling that, hey, if it's really real for me, if I'm really experiencing higher consciousness in my relationship to understanding the UFO phenomena and different metaphysical type thoughts, you will find in the moment-to-moment existence that what you feel, what you see, what you hear, and ultimately what you are projecting outwards from this realization, which is held in your mind and your heart, outward through your neurological system, in other words, what you're projecting out through your nervous system, towards the current, right now, the projected environment that is sitting in front of you, that means the people you meet, the work you do at your job, the relationship you have with your family, your kids, all the people that you're close with, the relationship even with yourself when you're alone, the relationship you have with everything you do, the relationship you have with driving in your car if somebody cuts you off, the relationship you have when you go in to get some gas, when you go into the grocery, everything, what you feel, see, hear, and project through your nervous system outwards towards the present projected environment, whatever it may be, good or bad, that is the living condition of your reality. It's not something else that you imagine yourself to be or wish you were, but it's exactly what you're projecting out right at this time. So take this idea, realize that our living condition is our immediate environment, and that our whole existence is created by the energetic thought forms that are projected out each moment into it. And this will make things very exciting and very clear for you. You can check yourself on this. I'm now just beginning to embark on a national tour to promote our Citizens for Scientific Reality campaign. I feel that when people discover the UFO phenomena and all of our limited concepts of thought and science, government, politics, religion, and education, when these are all challenged, I believe there will be a tremendous movement towards some of the thoughts and ideas shared here with you on this tape series. And I believe that there will be a revolution in the total thought process. And you can see it going on in our world today. Something is about to radically change. So as I go out on this tour, I hope to be entering your homes through the television and the radio. And I hope to see you at some of our seminars. And I would really look forward to sharing this whole existence with you. And I hope to meet you personally someday. This is Dr. Bell taking the helm again back from Scott Wolf. And I'm sure you had fun, as I did, listening to that part of the tape series. And as if you're watching and listening to the progression of this tape series, I'm sure that you're noticing that it's getting a little bit deeper and a little heavier all the time, a little bit more information, because this is not only something for you to listen to, it actually unlocks consciousness as it goes along by keying into certain sound mantras and timbres, which is what our music is all about, so that you can actually have an experience. When we get further into the tape theory, some of the music is quite acceptable to use with our systems. But now what I want to do is I want to talk about time and vibration. What happens is, if you look at human beings, they change. They're not to their sensitivities to what goes on over a period of time to different kinds of energies, both dimensional and interdimensional. For example, the Earth and the Moon have a rotational period together. And this particular period happens to be a 30-day cycle as the Moon goes around the Earth. When it goes around the Earth over a 30-day cycle, what happens is we have tide changes, we have changes in consciousness, the circadian rhythm, we have the 28-day cycle, 33-day cycle, and we also have the 30-day cycle. So we have a 28, 30, and a 33-day cycle. The Moon moves around the Earth at 2,300 miles per hour. And as the Moon rotates around the Earth, it causes serotonin changes in the human being.
For example, during a full moon, the serotonin levels have a tendency to be higher in the human brain and throughout the human body, and a non-spiritual entity will have a tendency to behave differently than a more spiritual entity because he's more tied into the whims of his physical body and less to the whims of the spiritual body. So what this means then is that if your chakras aren't tuned in to the moon changes, the sun, solar changes, and all the other changes, you're very susceptible to go upside down in a positive energy point, which is what the bulk of humanity does, which, as we talked about earlier in the aura field presentation, the aura fields are going upside down in people. Now, as we rotate the earth and the moon, as it goes through its cycle, it changes. The earth and the moon also rotates around the sun every 365 and a quarter days. That's why we have a leap year every 4 years. During its rotation around the sun, the earth goes through a earth change that would be construed as summer, winter, spring, and fall in the both north and south latitudes, each being the opposite. There is a vibratory frequency within the earth itself that's representative of the Christ energy, which we'll talk about more later on. And as this energy moves about from the north and the south pole and vacillates, it sets up a spiritual frequency within the earth, like a pulse or a heartbeat. During the winter months, where we talked about the Anu earlier, which is in the vitality globule, during the winter months, we have a situation whereby the natural death rate is at the highest, and during the wee hours of the winter months, and during the summer, death rates drop to the natural level, because another kind of vitality is there. When we have the cycle of the winter, the Christ energy is in the ground, and during the summertime, it's in the air. If you want to look at it on a simpler term. Now, when it's in the ground during the wintertime in the northern hemisphere, what happens is the trees sense this, a lot of other things sense this, and they go down into the ground where the sap and gain the energy of the Christ consciousness from the earth and charge off of this energy field. Then as the spring comes, the sap moves back up into the trees and plants, and the leaves open to the solar energy, and the Christ consciousness prevails more on the surface. And of course, during this time, the seed is produced. And if you remember, when it falls off the flowers and off the different trees in the fall, the seed then goes back in the earth and is vitalized through the winter by the Christ consciousness. The seed, by the way, in any form of food, contains the highest amount of energy in any food substance. It's always wrapped up in the seed, which gets a charge from underneath the ground. Now, as the earth and the moon and the sun rotate around the Pleiades, we go into a larger cycle, a much larger cycle of energy. And this cycle is 25,827.5 years. In this great cycle of 25,827.5 years, we have a sub-cycle. Divided by 12, we have 2,152.3 years. And so roughly what we're saying here is during the sun cycle, we have changes just like the earth and the moon had caused changes in the body over a 30-day period. And the earth, moon, and the sun caused changes in the body over a 365-day period. So do we have changes in the earth, sun, moon over a 25,827.5-year period, or the precession of the equinox? There's an old temple in Egypt, in the old spiritual city of Dendera, along the Nile River, and this is called the Temple of Hathor. It's dedicated to the goddess of love and the stars of Hathor, the Pleiades. In this temple, a marvel of man's beginning can be found. In eons-old carving on the ceiling, intricate in design, a star clock, first carved in the early B.C., celebrates the Pleiades, the vastly greater sun around which our solar system revolves, taking 25,827.5 years to complete the revolution. Called the precession of the equinoxes, this clock of stone survived the ages. Now, when we look at this cycle, we realize that 2,000 152.3-year subcycles. These cycles are called ages. Piscean age we're coming out of, Aquarian age we're going into. Coming out of the Piscean age, we are coming out of an age where the spiritual beliefs of people was, I believe, they believe. But in order to have a belief system, they had to have an idealism. And so this was the birthplace of religion. The level of soul changes during these 2,000-year periods, and there's 12 levels of soul that enters into our cycle at different periods of time on the precession of equinox, and the level of soul consciousness that entered into the soul during the rotation of the sun and earth around the Pleiades during the Piscean or Christ times was the believer. And because the believer needed the system of belief, all these different religions were structured during that time. Of course, there are older religious structures that intertwined through these younger religions. I would say Christianity had its birth 2,000 years ago, Catholicism, and all the other types of religions bounding around that had their birth in that time. Before that, of course, the Jewish faith was much older, and beyond that, the oldest surviving of the faith, which is the Brahmin faith of Tibet. But looking back during all these different times, the strongest period of the belief system was the last 2,000 years. And we had to have the believers. Now, when you look into the Aquarian age, which we're going into now, the level of the soul that's born now is a higher of consciousness, and it's the knower. These people don't have to have a religion to stand on, to stand upright in this world, and they don't have to have a 5 or 6 set version of the Global 2000 report to realize the planet's in trouble. They know by looking around and feeling the sensing. And as a result of that, the knowers, which...
Well, we ran out of time on that one, so anyway, we'll continue around next weekend.